Well, good evening. I found out, I was talking with Bruce, I probably should have talked to him before this, but on Sunday, what I gathered from the announcements was we were halfway through. Jehu, he told me we're all the way through. So maybe you might get a little bit more of a review than I normally might do on Jehu, but we'll go and talk about him. We'll begin talking about him and get back into the swing. I'll be picking up the class and going through the rest of the kings. We're kind of moving on towards judgment, and we're starting to see the shift towards that. It's kind of an interesting shift we're seeing, because you see in the reign of Jehu, in Israel, Baal worship is stifled pretty good. I mean, it happened with Elijah on the Mount of Carmel, but a lot of the actors in Baal's service were killed, but here you're going to see a real stifling of Baal worship in Israel, which is a good thing. Through, you know, Israel kind of abandoned God, and it was like 75 years after Jeroboam started his idolatry where Baal worship came in. Now we're kind of pushing the, I think, 120, 130 year mark or somewhere in that range. So it's been a while, and you see kind of the degradation of Israel, and pretty much all the kings of Israel they did evil in the sight of the Lord. I mean, you just see it all down the list. I don't know that I've seen one where it went the other way. So Judah had some hope, but Israel has been kind of on a downhill grade the whole time. Jehu comes in, and he's a shift in dynasty. So this is a good thing. It's coming at the will of the Lord. God had predicted with Ahab that his family would be utterly wiped, not just wiped off the throne, but utterly wiped out, because he introduced Baal worship and really embraced Baal worship. What it says about Ahab is it was almost as if what the other kings of Israel who all did evil in the sight of the Lord did was as nothing. And he really took it to the next level. So God determined judgment against the house of Ahab. Yet, towards the end of Ahab's reign, there was this brief little moment where Ahab repented to some extent. And the Lord didn't pull back his judgment, but he did say, not in your lifetime. So it allowed Ahab to have a little bit of peace during his life, and after him, his son took the throne, but then shortly after, we have Jehu being anointed again by Elisha and coming in and bringing in judgment. That's a lot of probably what you covered last week, is just, you know, Jehu, he comes in. First, he's serving the king, and Elisha anoints him. He turns on a dime, starts heading into town, into Jezreel. They're thinking, Is it peace? Well, what do you have to do with peace? Get behind me, right? And so he's running in. They don't know exactly who it is, but judging by the way he drives his chariot, they have an idea. And so the king comes out to meet him. Is it peace? And he's like, and he basically shoots him out of his chariot with an arrow. So that's what happens there. The king of Judah happens to be around as well. I think Ahaziah or Amaziah, one or the other. He shot too. He survives for a time, escapes to Megiddo, ends up dying there. So you have this real drama, you know, where he's just, the betrayal is heavy, treachery, you know. And I think, you know, he says treachery, then anyway. So you have this problem and that Jehu's dealing with. So he kills them. Then he goes find his sons. Well, first he goes and kills Jezebel, and he doesn't do it. What he says is, if you're with me, throw her out the window. And what they knew that to mean is, if you don't throw her out the window, you're all going to die in there. And that, so Jezebel's tossed out the window. They go and eat dinner. They get finished eating dinner, they go to bury her body, and all that's left is her feet, her hands, and her head, because the dogs ate her, and she didn't get a proper burial, according to the word of the Lord. And that's really an important thing, as you see in this, is you start seeing fulfillment of the word of the Lord. It's a pretty powerful thing. And even in Israel, in this nation that pretty much from its foundation has not served God well and has done evil in the sight of the Lord is working in that nation. He's giving people reasons to believe. He's calling faithful men in various degrees of faith. And that's what you see with Jehu. It's interesting, in the end of Jehu's, in the end of the chapter of Jehu, it says he carried out the will of the Lord. And one of the things Jehu says is, not one word of the Lord is going to fall to the ground. That's one thing he says. Then it says, he continued in the sin of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat. He didn't even get rid of the idolatry, the idols to that Jeroboam set up. So you have kind of this mixed situation going on with Jehu, but this is what happens when people rebel against the Lord. It becomes a dimmer and dimmer light, and that's really what you see here with Jehu. Is he knew God, he saw God's mighty works, he took a hand in carrying out the judgment and the mission of God, and he did it with zeal. And yet he didn't know God, he didn't know God's law, he didn't know what God wanted him to do, and didn't really care to find out. He just continued on in the sins of his forefathers. So really, that's what we see in the reign of Jehu, is this, it's kind of a restart for Israel in a lot of ways. His dynasty was, he went through in 2 Kings chapter 10, sort of the term, I'm sure, I can imagine Bruce saying this, is, Ahab served Baal little. Jehu's going to serve Baal much. I'm sure Bruce emphasized that for you, because that's a great part of the story, right? Is he's just luring them in. He executes and think of the loyalty to Ahab. He calls to the men of I killed Ahab. Make one of his sons king and come fight against me. No one wants to do that. So what are we going to do? He's like, all right, well then put the heads of Ahab's sons, bring them out to me this time tomorrow morning. It doesn't give him a lot of time. And imagine if one of someone's son was entrusted your family, and you're like, okay, cut off his head. Like, a disloyal group of people. I mean, really, that's what you see, is this just disloyalty. Whatever's in my best interest, whatever serves me, I don't care about your kid. I'm willing to sacrifice them for my own good. So you just really see the darkness of that particular kingdom at that time. And then imagine, because, we watch movies and stuff and read, and some you might read something like this, but imagine if this was our town. So you take the exit on 11th Street off of I-90, and you get up to the top there, and there are 70 heads piled up on two different piles. Wouldn't that be a little disturbing? And that's probably, not everyone comes in. That's the exit I come off of. But not everybody comes off of that exit. But, the main entrance to town, whatever that is. When I grew up, I lived in Wilkeson, and they had this big arch as you came into town. It said, "Welcome to Wilkeson." And so there was one entrance that was the road in. So you, on either side of that arch, you got some heads piled up. It seems like that would be disturbing to the kids a little bit. It seems like that would be, the smell, just doing something that grotesque. It's hard to even imagine, and yet it kind of brings you back. That's the times they lived in. That was actually happening in that city at that time. So you just see the way things were going and how they acted, and you just see it's just a distance from God that we can't even really, or a distance from, our moral standards are a lot higher than that, or what we're willing to accept, which is a good thing. It's just kind of a side note. The world used to be like that. It's not that way as much anymore, and largely due to the influence of the gospel in the world. As the gospel came and then was printed in the 1500s, the world changed and has gone for the better in a lot of ways. And it's easy to get all down. Everything's getting worse and worse, and it's all going downhill. We're way, way better than piles ahead at the entrance of our cities. Right? We're way better than that. So we just got to put it into perspective, and the kind of things that they were dealing with in this time was pretty grotesque, pretty heartless. And I mean, I can't even imagine cutting off anyone's head, especially someone who is in my care. It just, you know, it's just a totally different world we live in, and this is a good reminder of really where sin's going to lead you. You know, this is just the end of the road of sin. Mark?
I can't remember if it made a difference, that kind of violence on that society at the time, like, served as a warning to serve God instead. Because Jacob had a little bit of inkling, like, he wanted to root for him to do the right thing, but and then he had pieces and moments of it, but yeah.
I don't really think it did. I don't think it really even caught. It just said, here's what happened, but it didn't really make a moral thing. But it, to me, it was just, I was just imagined, what would it be like for me if I was driving into town and there were some heads piled up on the side of the road? That just seems pretty vicious, you know. And you know, and even in our time, though, there are places in the world where Christians live in societies that would do things like that. And so just a reminder for us to be grateful for where we live, and the opportunities we have in serving God and also in just living life. So he does that along the way, and I find that it's sort of after this. Did you talk much about Jehonadab? Did you bring up the Jeremiah passage on him?
I did.
Okay, so this is actually Jehu is zealous for serving God. He's going to see the mission through. He's a general, and they fought with knives and swords and arrows and stuff, so that's kind of his thing. Anyway, just as a warrior in those days, he's on the way. He comes across a man named Jehonadab, and this is in 2 Kings 10. We'll start in 10 and 11. This is not what I'm looking for. Give me a moment. Oh, verse 15. Excuse me. Yeah, so I'll start in verse 14. He said, take them alive. So they took them alive and killed them at the pit of Beth Eked, 42 men, and he left none of them. Now when he had departed from there, he met Jehonadab, the son of Rechab, coming to meet him. And he greeted him and said to him, is your heart right as my heart is with your heart? And Jehonadab answered, it is. Jehu said, if it is, give me your hand. And he gave him his hand, and he took him up with him into the chariot. And he said, come with me and see my zeal for the Lord. So he made him ride in his chariot. When he came to Samaria, so he made him ride in his chariot. So here you just have this kind of, are you with me? And Jehonadab says, yes, I am. So he takes him up into his chariot, kind of a sign of friendship and alliance and trust, and they go together. I don't know what it would be like riding with Jehu, according to his reputation for how he drives. But he hops up in there, so you see a little bit of trust in there as well. They go together. They start saying, they lure out the servants of Baal. And here's an interesting thing in this story. Let me just look through here. In verse 23, it says, Jehu went into the house of Baal with Jehonadab, the son of Rechab, and he said to the worshippers of Baal, search and see that there is no one here with you, none of the servants of the Lord, but only the worshippers of Baal. I like this verse. Jehu had a mission. He was going to serve the Lord. He was set on doing that. And he found someone to stand by his side, a true friend. Now, what do you want your friend to be like? You know, someone you're serving the Lord with, someone you're standing side by side with. You want someone who's going to walk into the snake pit with you and make sure there's no servants of God in that snake pit. Can you imagine what it would be like walking into that temple of Baal? And leading them to some extent in their worship, because he said after he made the offerings, So Jehu had to participate to some extent. He waited till they were vulnerable and then sent in men to kill them all. But Jehonadab stood by his side. And, you know, we may not have that kind of a situation going on, but we do need friends like that. We need allies like that. We need to be that for one another. You know, when the time comes, hey, are you with me? Are you for the Lord? Are we going to make sure the Lord's word is fulfilled in every way? Then let's go together. And so it's just one of those things. I just find this kind of neat that you see. And wherever it led them, they went together as brothers in this particular mission. So you see that little just that little piece of loyalty. Now, who is Jehonadab? This is an important thing. In Jeremiah 35, there's like a little passage, and God uses Jehonadab as a sermon illustration. So Jeremiah meets his family, the family of Jonadab. He's called Jonadab in Jeremiah. This is Jeremiah 35, 6 through 19. He meets his family, and the family, they don't drink wine at all. Them, their sons, their wives, their daughters, nobody drinks wine. The whole family does that. They also live in tents, they're nomadic. They don't own land. They don't settle in anywhere. And Jeremiah meets them and talks to them, and this is what we do. And the word of the Lord came to Jeremiah and said, this family listens to the word of their father, Jonadab, and yet I appeal to my people over and over, and my people won't listen to me. And he blesses this family. The Lord said, because they have been faithful to the word of their father, I'm going to bless them. But Israel, or I think Judah is going to be judged because of their rebellion against me. I just thought that was a really interesting thing. It just kind of struck me. Is you see the character of Jonadab with Jehu, but then you see as a leader in his family, he was a man who was for the Lord. And his commitment to serving the Lord, to seeing the Lord's word carried out in his home, passed on generationally through his family. And his family honored him. And God saw that and said, I wish it were that way with my people. I just find this is an interesting thing. It's just, he didn't live in good times. He lived in very rough times and in very godless times. And yet he was still able to have this impact on his family. And it was an impact that God used as a sermon illustration for Judah when Jeremiah was preaching a few I think Jeremiah was preaching maybe 100 years after this or something. So it was quite a ways after this. And he's being used as an illustration even up to that day. So just kind of interesting to me. You kind of see the character of the man and the impact the man has on his family. And also a faithful family. You just kind of see all those pieces in there. So any thoughts or comments on that?
It's interesting that this Jonadab was able to go in between the two kingdoms. He could go from Israel and into Judah, and he was still faithful to the Lord. And I think there's probably some providence involved there. The Lord allowed him to be saved in between those.
Yeah. And also, he made some decisions for his family. We're not going to settle in this land. We're going to be nomadic. We're just going to travel around, and we're going to we're going to not put down roots in a society like this. And you just kind of see him deciding for his family, we're going to be something different. So I just think, this would be a really interesting study just to kind of go in a little bit more in depth and kind of parse apart some of the things that said about him. But, as far as leading your family and what that looks like and maybe what can we learn from that, especially because we kind of are in the same boat as Christians, right? We sing a song, "This world is not my home." We're nomadic in a sense because we're not putting down roots. We're not committing ourselves to this world. Our family's just passing through it. We happen to be in a location, but our real loyalty is not here. And it seems like that's where Jonadab was with his family as well, is they made some commitments because they realized we're not going to, this isn't the home we're looking for, this isn't what we're trying, we're going to establish ourselves with the Lord. And that really was his goal there. So, after Jehu, so he cleaned it up quite a bit. He reigned for a while, and I think Jehu reigned for 28 years in Israel, beginning of a new dynasty. And you see, at least his sons weren't horrible. They weren't the best, but they're not bringing in Baal worship and stuff like that. There's just kind of some interesting things, some interesting contrasts we can draw out with his two sons, and that's really what we'll talk about for the rest of the evening. So Jehoahaz became king in Israel, and I want to look in 2 Kings chapter 13. It just we'll do the comment on Jehoahaz's heart. 2 Kings 13, verse 2. He did evil in the sight of the Lord and followed the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, with which he made Israel sin. He did not turn from them. So the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel, and he gave them continually into the hand of Hazael, king of Aram, and into the hand of Ben-Hadad, son of Hazael. There's one verse. We'll just go past it. I was going to talk about Jehu at the end of his life. It says he continued following the sin of Jeroboam. And so God started taking pieces of his land and giving it to Hazael. And so he was always kind of in this losing ground kind of a situation because he wouldn't turn to serve the Lord. Even though he was faithful, he was always losing ground because he wasn't truly faithful. So I thought that was just kind of a good segue into this. But here, Jehoahaz has the same problem. He's being plagued by these men on the border. And I believe Aram kind of had a thing going against Assyria at this time. But they still had the ability to kind of put pressure on Israel, even though they were fighting against Assyria too. And so they were kind of back and forth and fighting. So he did evil in the sight of the Lord. The Lord had this kind of blight of a nation, attacking them, taking land, raiding them from time to time. Verse 4. Then Jehoahaz entreated the favor of the Lord, and the Lord listened to him. And he saw the oppression of Israel, how the king of Aram oppressed them. The Lord gave Israel a deliverer, so that they escaped from under the hand of the Arameans, and the sons of Israel lived in their tents as formerly. Isn't that interesting? I just like this little piece. It's like, he did evil in the sight of the Lord. He had these problems, but he did turn to the Lord. And when he turned to the Lord had compassion. I just find this interesting. It's just, you see, you know, one of the things you see in the kings of Israel is you see this compassion of God. You see with Ahab, the Lord showed mercy to him. Really didn't need to, but he did. And every time someone, it's like, you know, is they start turning towards God, they get the glimpse, oh, you know, maybe in the corner of their eye, you know, where God is, their back's turned on them, but they just kind of get enough to get a glimpse that way and think on that for a minute. And God is like, yeah, let's have more of that. And he blesses them. He has compassion on them. He calls them to himself. And this is a very comforting verse. Because sometimes we can be probably in our own relationship with God get discouraged. Is he going to turn away from me? Am I not good enough? Or, you know, all these thoughts we have when we're struggling, or maybe when we had a problem and actually stumbled or let up on our faith in some way, and we think, am I okay? Am I good enough? But what you see here is you see God's desire to show compassion. He's not resentful. He's not, he must do what's right. But where he can have compassion, he will. And even in his affliction is for the sake of causing someone to turn to him. And that's one of the things you start seeing in this is the king, Jehoahaz, entreated the favor of the Lord. The Lord listened to him. You know, some people will go to John chapter 9, I think it's verse 29, It says, we know God doesn't hear the prayers of sinners. And a lot of people will teach that and say, see, you got to be right with God for him to hear your prayers. But actually, it's totally out of context, that particular verse. That's not, you know, it's not someone who's inspired saying it. It's just some guy. But here what we see is, no, there are times when God does hear the prayer of sinners. This man was a sinner. He was not even really serving God in any way. He just entreated him out of desperation. And yet the Lord heard. And it's one of those things, not just for us. How many people do you know that really don't know the Lord, but they're in a trouble and you say, can I pray with you? And they're like, yeah, please pray with me. You know, what you're doing is you're giving them this opportunity. You're entreating the Lord with them. They may not even serve God, but they're looking back and seeing a glimpse of something. And God hears those prayers, and God works on those people's behalf, calling them to him. And so it's really important, not just for, you know, to encourage other people and to do it with them, but also to do it for them at times, because the Lord is looking to call people to him. And there's all sorts of people who are suffering. And also, you know, you start looking at, you know, leaders of our country. They need this. This man was a king, and he wasn't a good king. And yet, when he entreated the Lord, when he had a glimpse of something good, and he thought about God, God heard him and had compassion on them. I hope that for our leaders. I hope that for our enemies, really. You know, you don't want your enemy to always be your enemy. Oh, if we have enemies. I hope that for, you know, the people who are the criminals. Something, you know, recently I've had occasion to look at the Kootenai County Jail roster from time to time. And you gotta scroll through, there's all sorts of people on there, all sorts of crimes that they've committed. But, you know, all those people need to have God's compassion, need to maybe take some time to entreat him. There's all sorts of places where this comes in. And it just gives us hope. And in our mission to save souls, this should be a huge encouragement to us. Because you might look at someone and say, I don't know about that guy. I don't know if there's a chance. There wasn't probably much of a chance for Ahab, and yet the Lord heard him. There wasn't much chance for Jehoahaz, and yet the Lord heard him. And it doesn't matter what you think. The Lord knows, and he's going to work on his behalf. And you know, New Testament says, I want prayers on behalf of all men. Because the Lord wants all people to come to a knowledge of him and to be saved.
Where I look at the lesson for us on this is don't make judgments. I mean, yeah, we can see the fruits of an individual, and we can see that they're wicked, they're evil, or whatever. But at the same time, if God was willing to give Ahab some faith, you know, who am I to say that there's anybody else that, if I'm in an opportunity to, you know, to give them that chance.
Yeah.
Yeah, I need to reevaluate my own attitude if I'm not willing to do that.
Yeah. No, that's a great point, and that's really one of the, and sometimes that's hard, especially when someone did something against you personally. This stuff starts getting harder. But you know, realistically, when it says a king continued in this evil practice of what Jeroboam did, that is something against God personally. And God is not just he's watching innocence be corrupted by this false worship. That's what God is seeing. He's seeing people that could belong to him being caused astray by these leaders and by these people. And yet, he still has compassion on them, even though it's a sin directly against him. I appreciate this little tidbit to see what God does. He gives them a deliverer, and verse 6, nevertheless, this is 2 Kings 13, verse 6, nevertheless, they did not turn away from the sins of the house of Jeroboam, with which he made Israel to sin, but walked in them, and the Asherah also remained standing in Samaria. For he left it, so there you see he, even though all these things happened, God gave him a deliverer. In the end, it didn't make a difference for this guy. But that doesn't mean there's no hope for other people, and you just see. But though, even with it making no difference, God still did the good thing. So I appreciate that. Any thoughts or comments on this before we move forward? All right, so the next king, Jehoash, and we'll look in verse 9, it says, "And Jehoash slept with his fathers, and they buried him in Samaria. And Joash, his son, became king in his place. In the 37th year of Joash, king of Judah, Jehoash, the son of Jehoahaz, became king over Israel in Samaria and reigned 16 years." So here's what I tend to want to do. Is I'll just, because there's Jehoash and Joash, and there's Joash of Israel and Joash of Judah reigning at the same time. So for Israel, I give the formal name Jehoahash, and for Judah, I give the informal name Joash. So that's how I'll make the distinction if I need to. So Joash will be always referring to Judah, just. We're not talking about him tonight, but I think they intersect a little bit. So, verse 14. So Joash, oh, verse 11, he did evil in the sight of the Lord. He did not turn away from all the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, with which he made Israel to sin, but he walked in them. Now the rest of the acts of Joash and all that he had done in his might with which he fought against Amaziah, king of Judah, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Israel? So Joash slept with his fathers, and Jeroboam sat on the throne, and Joash was buried in Samaria with the kings of Israel. When Elisha became sick, verse 14. So it just kind of gives the brief thing, and then there's a few tidbits we can pick up about the reign, what happened during the time of Jehoash. And Jehoash, the prophet of his time, was Elisha. Elisha was old. In fact, it says in verse 14, when Elisha became sick with the illness of which he was going to die, Joash, the king of Israel, came down to him and wept over him and said, my father, the chariots of Israel and its horsemen. Where did we hear that before?
Chariots of Fire.
Yeah.
The movie.
Nope. Nope. No, that's not it. Of course, maybe it is it, but I didn't know about that. Okay. So where do we hear this? The chariots of Israel and its horsemen. This is what Elisha said when Elijah was taken up in chariots of fire. So when I said yes, that's what I was thinking you meant at first.
No, I wasn't that. I wasn't that deep.
Oh, yeah. You're just quoting a movie. All right. Well, yeah, so when Elijah was taken up in the chariots of fire, Elisha said, my father, the chariots of Israel and its horsemen. The defense of Israel. You know, you're the one, you're the protector, you're the representative of God here. And this wicked king had that kind of relationship with Elisha. I just find this interesting. This is just kind of an interesting little bit. Even though it said he was evil, he had a relationship with Elisha. Presumably, Elisha liked him to some extent because they were close. And verse 15, Elisha said to him, take a bow and arrows. So he took a bow and arrows. Then he said to the king of Israel, put your hand on the bow. And he put his hand on it. And Elisha laid his hand on the king's hands. He said, open the window and shoot to the east. We're a little behind. All right, open to the window and shoot to the east. And he opened it. Then Elisha said, shoot, and he shot. And he said, the Lord's arrow of victory, even the arrow of victory over Aram. For you will defeat the Arameans at Aphek until you have destroyed them. Then he said, take the arrows, and he took them. And he said to the king of Israel, strike the ground. And he struck it three times and stopped. So the man of God was angry with him and said, you should have struck it five or six times. Then you would have struck Aram until you have destroyed it. But now you shall strike Aram only three times. Elisha died. So we'll stop right there. It's just kind of an interesting translation thing. So when he says strike the ground, the thing that comes to my mind is taking the bundle of arrows and hitting them on the ground. But I read in two separate commentaries, they're talking about translation, that when this word strike is used of an arrow, it means to shoot the arrow and strike the ground, just like the first one. Because he set a precedent, you shoot the arrow provides victory. Now I got a bundle of arrows, he's like, now strike the ground with them, start shooting them. So he takes them, shoots one, shoots the other, shoots three. He knows what he's doing. He knows. When I shoot this arrow, it's another victory. And he had a whole bundle of arrows, probably five or six more, I would guess, from what Elisha said. But he stops at three. And Elisha's mad. He's like, what are you doing? Why did you stop at three? You could have kept going. You could have shot them all. Why did you stop? And it's just kind of an interesting thing. It's like you had victory. Everything was there for you. All you had to do was ask God and put your faith in Him. And you didn't do it. And He was frustrated about that. And I did, but it makes me think about, do we ever fall short of that? I feel like we're a lot of times in the same situation. The Lord has provided a victory for us. He has given us what we need to succeed. And I think for whatever reason, where we stop before the supply is exhausted. And say, that's all. That's all I'm going to take. For whatever reason that is. But I just like this. It's kind of maybe a good reminder of us, one, for prayer, is pray a lot. Ask God for victory in whatever you're working against, whatever you're working towards, whatever things you got going on. Let's pray. Just in the recent year, 2 years, we've had prayer meetings. We've been praying at the beginning of our classes. And I feel like we've been praying a little bit more as a church. And it's been consistent for a time. And I feel we've been seeing some prayers answered in very encouraging ways. How many people have been pretty severely sick in our congregation and gotten better? Like, just stop and think. Over the last 2 years, how many times has that happened? There's been a lot of pretty severe sicknesses that have gotten better pretty quickly. And that's because we're praying about it and we're asking about it. It's just a reminder to us that the Lord hears our prayers. He answers them. He works on our behalf in a lot of ways. And this is a good little parable about that, right? Isn't it? God says, shoot arrows. What do you need to be doing? Shoot them all. Don't hold back. And sometimes if you think of an arrow as a prayer, you got five arrows, shoot five arrows. And I just like this little thing. But also there's a lot of other ways. Sometimes we cut ourselves short. We quit before we're exhausted. We don't use everything we have to serve the Lord. We hold back for whatever reason. And that's another thing we need to remember is you don't have to keep a tactical reserve when you're serving the Lord. Shoot all your arrows. Give all. Commit 100%. And it's not going to be wasted. It will benefit the Lord and likely you in at least spiritual ways, if not in other ways as well. So anyway, I just like that little picture. So Elisha tells the king, shoot the arrows. The king stops short, likely lack of faith. He's angry. He says, you could have shot them all, could have had the whole victory, but you weren't faithful enough. So just remember, keep that in mind when we read this next part. Verse 19. So the man of God was, or verse 20, Elisha died and they buried him. Now the bands of Moabites would invade the land in spring of the year. And they were burying a man, and behold, they saw a marauding band. And they cast the man into the grave of Elisha. And when the man touched the bones of Elisha, he revived and stood up on his feet. Now Hazael, the king of Aram, had oppressed Israel all the days of Jehoahaz. I just want to stop right there. It was interesting. My first question was, why is this in here? How does this, like, it seems like so out of place that, I mean, obviously it's a miracle, it's an encouraging story, but why is this included in this place of the scripture? What was the purpose of this? It's just something to think about, And that we'll talk about what that would have been like in a moment, but likely it was, you know, because what happens is these guys, they're going to bury someone. They're working on a grave. They see marauders. They're like, okay, just open this one, chuck him in there, put the lid on, we're out of here. They're going to get to safety. They throw the guy in, he pops up. What would that be like? I mean, that would be shocking, right? You throw your dead uncle back in the hole, he pops up out. Hey, what are you guys doing? Where are you going? Probably the band heard him, you know? I mean, God, anyway, this miracle takes place. Man brought back to life. Now, it is kind of interesting how a lot of Elisha's miracles mirror Elijah's miracles, but a little bit more fantastic. Elijah asked 3 times that the boy would be raised from the dead, and he was. Elisha, he just was dead bones and brought the guy back to life. But the reminder is to King Joash, Jehoash. He is saying, just remember, the Lord said something from Elisha. And you can have confidence in that. And really, that's the message, is you can have confidence in what I said would happen based on, here's a miracle to confirm what was said through him. Mark?
Elisha asked for double, right?
Yeah.
And then the Bible reports 8 miracles for Elijah and 16 for Elisha.
And a lot of Elisha's are similar to Elijah's? Yeah. No. Except for they're a little bit bigger scale.
Yeah.
So the woman had a little bit of oil in the jar that lasted. And Elisha's miracle was, she filled in all these gallons and vats of oil in their house. It was the same thing, a lot bigger. But yeah, with Elisha, the interesting is the confirmation that you're going to have the victory over Aram raising a man from the dead. It's kind of interesting that God's going to keep his word, I'm going to raise a man from the dead. And if you just take the picture of that, even though it may not be directly related to Jesus, but what's our confirmation that God's going to keep his promises?
Jesus.
God raised a man from the dead.
Yeah. He'd already done it.
Yeah. Different. Obviously, there are no bones in that tomb. And, you know, but, God raised a man from the dead. And it's just kind of but really the purpose, I think, was a reminder to Jehoash that God would keep his word through him. And in verse 23 here, it says, verse 22, it says, now Hazael, the king of Aram, oppressed Israel all the days of Jehoahaz, but the Lord was gracious to them and had compassion on them and turned to them because of his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and would not destroy them or cast them from his presence until now. I find this is also an interesting phrase to be put at this point in the text. Because of God's covenant, he would not destroy them. Now, if you want to say, what was Jesus all about? God made a covenant, and he gave us a deliverer who raised from the dead. You know, there's a lot of parallels in this little section, in this particular king. There's a lot of parallels in this and with the gospel. And I know the Lord puts these sort of literary types in Scripture, but I just find this really an interesting thing. But just that idea of God would not break his covenant. What were they doing? It doesn't matter. God was not going to break his covenant.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. That it wasn't dependent on the obedience of these people. They were not obedient. And in a sense, you see God's grace, but it's not really about his grace either. It's all about the covenant, and he would not violate what he had already agreed to with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He just couldn't do that.
Yeah. Yeah, and he wouldn't. And he knew when he made that promise, days like this would come, and he kept them anyway. And he kept them because he made the promise. He was not going to violate it. Yeah, so I just find this is a very fascinating little section of Scripture that if you really take time to think, okay, how does this point us to Jesus? Because many of these stories will point us to Jesus. But if you ask, how does this point us to Jesus? There's a lot of ways this points us to Jesus. There's a lot of things you can pick up out of this that would direct us to understand Jesus. And the thing that's interesting about that is God was thinking about Jesus when he inspired the writer of this. You know, he already had that plan in place, and he's giving us ways to understand what he does. So, Jehoash goes and God gives deliverance from Hazael, king of Aram. And so we're going to take a look at this. This is our last little piece where we see a war. So God delivers Israel from Aram. Joash actually was pretty good, general leader or leader of an army, and he secured his borders pretty well. Then this young whippersnapper in Judah, Amaziah, becomes king. And he goes out and fights against Edom, and feels like he's pretty big deal. I whoop them, I'm going to whoop Israel. So he sends a letter up to Israel and says, let's go ahead and fight each other. Verse 8, 2 Kings 14:8. Amaziah sent messages to Jehoash, the son of Jehoahaz, son of Jehu, king of Israel, saying, come, let us face each other. Jehoash, the king of Israel, sent Amaziah, the king of Judah, saying, the thorn bush, which was in Lebanon, sent to the cedar, which was in Lebanon, saying, give your daughter to my son in marriage. But there passed by a wild beast that was in Lebanon and trampled the thorn bush. What do you think about that? The thorn bush is Amaziah. The cedar tree is Jehoash. And some random animal walks by and tramples the bush. And the point is,
stay home.
You are not as big a deal as you think you are. And that's what he says next is, you have indeed defeated Edom, and your heart has become proud. Enjoy your glory and stay at home. For why should you provoke trouble that even so that you, even you, would fall and Judah with you? But Amaziah would not listen, so Jehoash, king of Israel, went up, and he and Amaziah, king, faced each other at Beth Shemesh, which belongs to Judah. Judah was defeated by Israel, and they fled each to his tent. Then Jehoash, king of Israel, captured Amaziah, king of Judah, the son of Jehoash, the son of Ahaziah, at Beth Shemesh. And he came to Jerusalem and tore down the wall of Jerusalem, the gate of Ephraim, to the corner gate, 400 cubits. He took all the gold and silver and all the utensils which were found in the house of the Lord and in the treasuries of the king's house, the hostages also, and returned to Samaria. What's interesting about this fight? For one, he was a little too big for his britches. For two, who was the righteous king and who was the unrighteous king? The king of Israel, in 13 verse 11, did evil in the sight of the Lord. That's what it says. In 14 verse 3, Amaziah, he did right in the sight of the Lord, yet not like David his father, he did according to all that Joash his father had done. So he left some of the high places. He did right in the sight of the Lord, basically lived good. The other guy did evil in the sight of the Lord, but the other guy got the victory. Why is that?
Maybe on the same reasons that Joshua, when he went to Canaan, initially he went to the Lord to inquire about everything. But when he didn't, it came back to him in a big way. And Israel forever after that, actually. So even if you have a right relationship with God, you need to maintain it. You need to not get lax in it, not get lazy in it. You need to keep it on, because even the bad guy, it's like they say, a blind pig can find an acorn every once in a while.
Yeah.
So, you know, just by sheer luck, you can do something right.
My thinking on this is, and I think that's probably right, is maintaining the relationship. And also, the seriousness of how you serve. But in there's a thing that it points out, very specifically. You're proud. You might be right with God, but you're being proud right now and you need to realize what you're doing. You can stay home and be satisfied. Don't be proud and try and take what you can't have. You know, that's one of the things is, even if you're right with God, your pride is going to be a problem for you. And that's what we see here. And it isn't always going to be the righteous who are going to correct you. In this case, it was an unrighteous king correcting a righteous king, giving him wise advice, and Amaziah wasn't going to listen to it. He did what he wanted to do. And
if the king was proud in that way, and it looks like it was, that level of pride probably filtered down to the rest of the commanders and the leaders in the military and other aspects of the kingdom. I mean, that most people follow, they emulate what the leader did.
Yeah. What was the and what was the cost of the pride?
The nation.
In a lot of ways, the nation. Yeah. A major setback in the nation, at least, right? The wall destroyed, treasury raided, temple of God raided. Mark?
Maybe not giving credit to God. It's like, I did this victory, I have this, my own. I can do this too.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. As he didn't give credit to God, wasn't fearing the Lord, and wasn't honoring him. And so, yeah, I just find this is another interesting little story there. And, you know, there's a proverb, pride cometh before the fall. And here you see that exact thing. You see that played out. But you see, what you're seeing is also, we were talking about the hearts of the kings. What we're seeing here is, here's a heart condition this king had. And what's the result of that? That's one of the nice things about these, is you can actually see how does this play out in life for them. So maybe we can avoid some of having these things play out in our own life. This is where we're going to stop tonight. Are there any thoughts or questions, anything to add to this before we close? All right, if not, let's close in a word of prayer.